There was a day not long after I moved to Wisconsin. It was winter, and I had never really driven much in snow, and there was a big snowstorm, and of course, I managed to get my car stuck in a snowdrift. And I remember sitting there in the car, and the tires were spinning and spinning, and I didn't know what to do. And there was a knock on the window, and this old guy was standing outside, and he had on one of those big, you know, fur hats with the big ear flaps. And he leaned in and said, "Do you have any kitty litter?" And I thought, I don't even have a cat. There are things you learn when you live in a place for a while. Things the old-timers know that get passed down or handed on. Like the fact that when your tires are spinning on ice, kitty litter works better than sand. And a bag of it weighs a lot less, too. I'm Anne Strange-Champs, and today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, local knowledge. Things you didn't learn in school or on the internet, but in person. From someone like this.
My name is Lars Mytting. I live in a place called Elverum, which is at the very edge of the forest belt called the taiga.
If you're thinking where, I did too. I looked it up. The taiga is a gigantic snow forest, cuts across a huge swath of northern Europe, all the way from Siberia to southern Norway. And that's right where Lars lives. So if there's one thing that people in that area know, it's wood. How to chop it, stack it, season it, heat their homes with it. And Lars, who's a journalist and a writer, recently gathered all that collected wisdom and he put it in a book called Norwegian Wood, which turned out to be a huge bestseller. What kind of things does it tell you? Well, for one thing, if you're a woman on the lookout for a good husband, the first thing you might want to check out is his woodpile.
For example, if you had a very, very big woodpile, you would have a man with high ambitions, but who perhaps did not know his own limits. And on the other hand, if you have a low stack, then perhaps you have one that's cautious, but he may also be shy or weak. And you have, you know, the artistic man who likes to, you know, make different shapes of and sculptures out of the stacks, which may be nice to look at, but perhaps he is wasting his energy on something that won't be very fruitful.
So what kind of wood pile do you want to look for if you're looking for a good husband?
I'd advise that you should look for a lot of wood. That's fresh and not moldy. And if you have a variation of logs, small and big logs together, that's also a good sign because we need a mixture of the big logs for the really cold nights, but also smaller ones to make it easier to start the fire. And I wouldn't really advocate marrying someone with this extremely pedantic wood piles.
What's a pedantic wood pile?
Well, if they are obsessively perfect, the man may have lost some connection to reality and just observed the... or they have too much time. Perhaps they are just waiting for the right woman to show up. But generally, you know, we often have competitions in local newspapers here on the competitions for the best wood pile.
No, wait, I didn't know that.
Oh, that comes every year with local newspaper, and people send photos of their own or their husband's or wood piles.
This reminds me that there's a guy in Norway who's built wood piles that are so sculptural. He's made, well, one was of the composer Rossini, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know them. They are great folks. They are old, so they have lots of time. I forgive him. And he's already married.
Has he done anything besides Rossini?
The first really good one he did was of the local mayor, a cartoon of him. The next year came Rossini. And then for the royal anniversary, he made perhaps the most perfected one, which was of the Norwegian royal family, the king and queen of Norway.
In the shape of a wood pile.
Yes. He's considered, say, the masterclass of wood pilers here in Norway.
So this is a kind of deep knowledge, deep lore that goes way back in Norway. I'm not sure that people in the U.S. know that much about wood. Most of us don't heat our homes with wood, for one thing. So there really is a Norwegian or Scandinavian way of wood or wood culture?
Yes, absolutely. It sounds a bit nerdy, I understand. But but the thing is that our tradition has never been broken by coal. It's recorded back to the Viking era that there was a quite developed knowledge on how to get the properly seasoned firewood.
So tell me some of this old knowledge. I mean, what's the proper way to build a wood pile? The Norwegian way. It's not as simple as you just go out, you chop down a tree, you split some logs, and that's it. You're ready for a fire.
It's possible to write 192 pages about it. So, yes, it's no. There are lots of interesting small details around it. Really, one of them, which I thought was the most obscure, was to observe the moon phase, to chop firewood on a sinking moon.
So when the moon is waning, that's when you chop
waning,
the wood?
Waning, yes, that's right. And I thought, well, this is certainly some folklore which has no basis in truth. But some applied science actually found that trees had cycles, monthly cycles.
Just like women.
And that's right. In the 1990s, a Swiss scientist made a very, very big project with 400, I was supposed to say women, but 400 trees. And they found that the trees were shrinking and expanding near the full moon, but it was definitely possible to measure it. So
that's just fascinating. And it says so much about these old traditions and old pieces of knowledge that we, you know, in our current scientific age tend to dismiss as just so much old nonsense.
One of the things I like to do when researching and writing is to just not abandon a old myth, but try to go to the core of it and find out, you know, what was the foundation of the myth. And very often I found that there was a certain truth to it.
Hmm. Are there things you still feel you haven't been able to convey in words about wood?
In essence, what I tried to capture in the book was the magic of connecting to nature and to the seasons. After the book was done, I found, quite to my surprise, how universal this subject is, because it was a big hit in Norway and no one really expected that it should be. The book was close to not getting published at all because people thought it was a bit too weird a subject or too obvious a subject. But the big surprise that I had, and which still surprises me, is how profound the connection between people and from all sorts of countries and cultures, how profound a connection they still have with firewood.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you about the art of actually building a fire, because reading your book taught me that I've been doing it completely the wrong way for years and years. So tell me how to build a fire the Norwegian way.
There is a saying, there's no smoke without fire, but it's absolutely possible to make a fire without any smoke at all.
Really?
Yes, it is. It may sound like I'm a bit off the edge of normal mental health, but what I've been doing is I've been standing on the roof right by the chimney investigating, say, have I made a perfect fire now? And the
and you could stand up on your roof to see if any smoke is coming out of your chimney?
That's right, because if you have smoke out of the chimney, it's basically like gas leaking from a car. It's energy wasted. So if you have a perfect fire, you will not have any smoke at all.
But how do you get a fire like that?
The main thing is obviously the clean burn technology, which is in modern stoves. But the other thing is to build the fire upside down. And this may sound like a contra logic and obviously different to what most people do. Instinctively, we would take some kindling and set fire to it, and then put small sticks of wood on top of the kindling, mm-hmm. and then the bigger logs on top.
Right.
But what will happen is that the bigger logs, they will be warm enough to let the gas out from the log, but it won't be hot enough to set fire to that gas. And we need to set fire to all the gas released in order to burn with no pollution. So the method is called the valley and bridge method, where we build a layer of logs, two or three layers perhaps. On top of that, I put two logs in parallel and put some small sticks on top of that kindling.
So you that, burn it with the kindling and the small stuff on top?
On top, yes. And what will happen is that you have flames on top, and as the heat goes downwards, the gas and the smoke is released. But there will always be flames on top. And that way, you get a much warmer fire, simply because you use all the potential energy in the wood. And the hotter it gets, the cleaner it also gets. Mm. So there is nothing to gain, really, from a smoking stove. In Norway, we have a word for it. We call heating the crow.
Heating the crow?
Heating the crow, yeah. We let the heat out to the crow instead right. of...
the people indoors.
Instead of, keeping it indoors.
Lars Mytting lives in Elverum in Norway. His best-selling book, Norwegian Wood, Chopping, Stacking, and Drying Wood the Scandinavian Way, is now available in English.
Without wood, firewood, dry wood, there's not a stove in the world's gonna do you any good. Without wood, we could,
you should be
out cutting some.
Throw it in the oil drum.
What do you think your saw is for?
You can always use some.
Sometimes, traditional knowledge gets adopted in unlikely places. For instance, La Crosse, Wisconsin, not too far from us. A lot of Hmong people settled there after the Vietnam War, and there's a community center where the Hmong gather, and in the back of that building, there's a blacksmith shop, where to this day people pound burning strips of metal into traditional Hmong knives. Producer Maureen McCollum recently visited and met master blacksmith Tong Kai Vang, and his apprentice and translator, Kong Mong Yang.
This is actually the very first knife that I made that looks kind of really decent. The belly and the shape of it is really, looks really well. The belly is the sharp part, the widest part from the back to the blade. He's made probably like 2,000 or 3,000 knives just in Thailand and in Laos. Right now, we just use kind of like scrap pieces of metal, so it's a lot of blacksmith master here like using as car shocks because they're really malleable and they keep their sharpness. So they use that in like lawnmower blades. Once they get like dulled or like not used, we use that to like, make knives. For a normal like a small knife, which is about 6 inches, it's good for like just cutting fruits and vegetables and outside like gardening work. And then we also have the bigger knives, which are like a foot and a half, I want to say. They're really good for cutting meat and also cutting like small brushes. He said the one that he likes the most are the big Hmong knife that's like cut up on the tip, and it's used to cut like branches and brushes and also doing farm work. In Thailand, there's this this plant, almost like a tree plant, for pigs to eat. Then you go cut them down and you just like chop it up and then you give it to the pigs. Those are his favorite ones. I wasn't born in the United States, but I was like pretty much raised here, so I don't know a lot of stuff about Hmong people, and so it's always like a good thing to know more about my own culture. So. So when he was young, he didn't really know how to blacksmith, but he kept watching his grandfather and his cousins. When he like immigrated to Thailand in 1979, they didn't really have anything to do there. So when they closed down that the camp there, and they had to move somewhere else, He had no way of making income, so that's when he actually started doing more blacksmith to support himself and his family. What they did is they built a blacksmith shop, and they made knives and hoes and then machetes and all this other tools for the Thai people. And they would come and buy it, or they could bring their old hoes that are bented and stuff, and they would fix it for them. And also, they didn't have anything to do at all, so that's all they could do. Chong Kai is a really, really great blacksmith. He is my mentor, and he's also more like almost like a grandfather to me. Like, so like I never really had grandparents that I knew. Like, one thing he taught me is like just keep on trying, and like you'll always succeed if you try.
That story comes from Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, a biologist taps her Potawatomi roots to both study and talk with plants. I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about traditional wisdom in this hour, and Robin Wall Kimmerer is a botanist who blends Western science with more traditional ways of knowing. She describes her field experiments as kind of like interviewing a plant. She believes nature is full of living beings, not just the plants and animals, but also the rocks and the wind. Kimmerer is both a PhD biologist and a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and she's trying to reconcile Western science with the wisdom of her Potawatomi elders. It's a process she spells out in her book, Braiding Sweetgrass. She stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
Robin, you've said that if you're going to be native to a place, you have to learn to speak its language. So what does it mean to learn to speak the language of, let's say, a forest, one of the places you study?
I think one of the most important ways to become part of your place is to know the names of your neighbors, just like in a human neighborhood. So to take the time to learn the names of plants, it's an exercise in paying attention. And just to know that, like in the winter, the texture of the different barks, in the summer, the taste of the different berries, to really engage all of your senses. And it helps you feel part of a place as well.
What can the taste of a berry tell you about the plant?
Well, the taste of a berry can tell you so much about the plant. It can tell you who eats it, the way the seeds are placed. You know, turtles eat one kind of berry, birds eat another kind of berry. And so the taste of them gives you kind of an insight into the web of their relationships.
Now, part of your heritage is you're a member of the Potawatomi Nation, and I know there's a tradition among Potawatomi elders of trees talking to each other. What does that mean?
Well, from a traditional perspective, our teachings are that there was a time in the world when the trees, the birds, the animals, and the humans all spoke the same language, that we could all communicate with one another and did so freely, but that we humans have forgotten how to do that. There's also a scientific way of knowing, and this is a place where scientific and traditional knowledge converge, actually, and the modern science of chemical ecology tells us the trees are talking to each other.
What are they saying to each other?
Oh, in our limited vocabulary that scientists have been able to decipher so far, they're sending warnings to each other. It's well-established science about how a tree that's under attack from a certain insect will send a chemical signal off through the wind to the other trees in the neighborhood that says, uh-oh, gypsy moths are coming, better turn on your defenses. They even have chemical signals that invite other beings to come visit them as pollinators, for example.
Now, you have an unusual background. I mean, you are not only a distinguished scientist and environmental biologist, but you are steeped in native traditions, particularly of the Potawatomi Nation. And can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. I grew up in the woods of upstate New York, far from our Potawatomi people, whose homelands are here in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest. And I grew up, in a sense, separated from the real materiality of traditional culture by way of the federal policies of removal and assimilation, in that my grandfather was one of those kids who was taken from his family, put on a train, and sent back east to Carlisle Indian School.
How old was he when that happened?
He was only 9 years old. Imagine that. And so that whole intentional process of deculturating a people. He was a victim of that. And I remember as a kid always asking my dad things about our language, things about practices. And he'd have to say, I'm sorry, sweetie, I don't know. That was all left on the doorstep of the Carlisle Indian School. And even as a little kid, I thought, if they could have a school that would take all that away from you, have you unlearn who you were, there ought to be a way that you can learn that again. And that really became a mission for me.
And you've actually gone back to study the Potawatomi language, right?
Well, study is a kind word. I'm definitely an amateur. I've taken advantage of the language revitalization programs that many of the Potawatomi communities have sponsored.
So what has struck you about learning this language, what you have learned so far?
One of the things is it's very difficult language, not only because the sounds are different, but it turns out that Potawatomi language is a verb-based language. In English, I think the number is like 70% of our words are nouns, whereas in Potawatomi, 70% of the words are verbs.
Really?
But it was in that difficulty that, for me, I discovered the thing that I love best about the language is the philosophy that underlies it. What we have are two cases of animate and inanimate verbs. You listen to an airplane with a different verb than you listen to a blue jay, because one is alive and one is not. And all the verbs are that way. There's a particular grammar for animacy. And that makes speaking and learning the language, for me, very difficult, but also really beautiful. Because what it means is that it's the acknowledgement that the world is alive, that all those plants and animals and rocks and water that I grew up with, having that sense of their vitality and their animacy, our language recognizes that.
So what would be some examples of verbs that are used in the Potawatomi language that, you know, in English, we would just have a noun to describe that thing?
The verb for a bay, that little inlet in a lake, that isn't a noun. It is the verb to be a bay. And at first I really scoffed at that, thinking, how is that possible? A body of water is not a verb. Oh, yes, it is, if that water is alive, if that water has agency, if that water can choose to be a bay now and a waterfall later. So that was just an electric moment for me of realizing that what this difficulty in the language is doing is actually acknowledging the life of the living world and speaking of it in that beautiful way.
I mean, this is so fascinating, because what you're talking about is you're talking about a different worldview.
Yes.
That words and the structure of the language conveys another way of seeing the world.
Absolutely. And the example that is for me so powerful is that when we think of that bay, or we think of the loon that's swimming in that bay, if you picture that loon for a second, in English, how do we speak of that bird? we have to say, I see it. It is diving for fish. It is calling before the rain. And we call it it. And it is the same word that we use for trucks and pencils, right? We use it for objects. And so in English, we're imprisoned in a worldview that objectifies nature, that objectifies and can therefore open the doors to exploitation of nature.
Now, my understanding of animistic traditions is that all of nature is considered alive. I mean, it's not just people, it's not just plants and animals, it's rocks, it's wind. How seriously do you take that view? I mean, you're a trained scientist.
I am a trained scientist. And, you know, in Biology 101, when we learn what does it mean to be alive, we also learn the categories, as you say, of what is alive. And we don't put rocks and waters and mountains in those categories. So we say that they're inert. We say that they're natural resources, if you will. But they have a different kind of life within them, a life that operates at a different pace with different scales and structures of organization. And so as a scientist, I try to be very careful to say that science is really a set of tools. It's a lens to look at the world. It's a lens. And if we look at rocks through the scientific lens and definition, scientific definition of what it means to be alive, they don't fit. But there's another lens in a different worldview.
So tell me, how are rocks alive?
Think about the way in which a boulder over time becomes sand. That is a transformation. Oftentimes in science, we adopt the scientific way of knowing as a bit of an intellectual monoculture, as if that's the only way to understand the world. And when we encounter something that doesn't fit that, we call it, oh, it's woo-woo, it's supernatural, and it doesn't fit science, and therefore it can't be real. If we can't measure it, it can't be real. Well, we may not be able to measure it, but that may just be because we haven't defined it properly and we don't have the right tools. If we think it doesn't exist, we don't have the tools to measure it.
Well, I'm sure that one of the reasons why science has tried to sort of turn all these pieces of nature into its is they want to get rid of all that spiritual stuff. And it would seem to fly in the face of what I understand of various animist traditions, which is, I mean, a lot of these parts of nature are connected to spirit beings in some way.
Yes. And in indigenous ways of knowing, we think about humans as having at least four capacities for knowing the world. One of them is intellectual. One of them is mental, right? One of them is physical. But that we also have spiritual and emotional ways of knowing the world. Whereas the scientific method, part of the power of the scientific method is that it uses only one of those four gifts. Well, maybe two, right? The intellect and the physical ability to sense and measure. But emotion and spirit we set aside, you know, Cartesian dualism. We don't talk about that. We only talk about the mechanism, about the rational perspective. And I honor that because a lot of the way that science has made advancements in understanding mechanism comes through that isolation. But science has absolutely no capacity to explore the role of spirit and emotion in the workings of the world. Science is really, really good at answering what I think of as true-false questions. That's what hypotheses are, right? They're true-false questions. And then you amass all those little bits into our understanding. And that's a fine way of knowing. But it isn't the only way of knowing.
Do you have experiences that we might call, I don't know, spiritual or mystical when you're out in the woods, out in nature, encountering other species, non-human species? Is that transformative for you at times?
I would say that it's no longer transformative in that I've turned a corner to expect that when I'm in the woods, I expect that I am surrounded by a community of other beings who know I'm there. And I know they're there, and we're in conversation with one another. It puts me in mind of one of those favorite anthropology stories of some anthropologist allegedly saying to a native person, a young woman, said, well, do you ever go alone into the woods? And she couldn't answer that question. And he writes in his journals how, well, she must be really quite dim if she couldn't answer the question of, do you go alone in the woods? And finally, in conversation, she revealed that that was really an oxymoron. You couldn't be alone in the woods because all of those other beings are there with you.
Has your understanding of some of these indigenous traditions that you've been describing, has it made you a better scientist?
Absolutely. I think that it helps me pay attention more to things that I have not set out to measure. When I go into the field, when I'm doing an experiment, I think about it as a kind of an interview. Because we no longer speak the language of these other beings, I'm going to do an experiment that allows that being to answer my questions in a way that I can understand. You know, dandelions, how do you feel about nitrate? I can't ask them that. But I'm going to give them different amounts of nitrate and see what they say. And they say through their biomass, through their rate of photosynthesis, whatever. To me, that's an interview with someone who doesn't speak your language. So somehow being able to, again, cross that boundary from scientist to plant, and that sounds really arrogant, like you could do that. But in some way, you can, from a really humble perspective of saying, I want to try to imagine what it's like to experience this world as the plant does.
To try to sort of take on some plant consciousness.
Yes, yeah. To say, what matters to you, plant? I think I know what matters to you as a scientist, but why don't you tell me? So that other kind of listening is, I think, makes me a better scientist.
Thank you. This has been great.
Thanks, Steve.
Robin Wall Kimmerer with Steve Paulson. Robin's a botanist at the State University of New York at Syracuse, and she's the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. I'm curious, does that animist view of the world resonate with you? We'd welcome your comments on our Facebook page. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
This is Philip Glass. I'm going to recommend a book by Wade Davis called The Wayfinders. It's not a new book, but I just recently was able to find it online, and I got a couple copies. He's an anthropologist. He was a resident anthropologist at the Geographical Society, I think, in Washington. He's written quite a lot of books, it turns out, but this is a new book. It is a survey of indigenous peoples, and the subtitle of the book, it says, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Societies Are Important to Us Today. Each chapter is maybe 30 pages, 6 or 7 chapters, so it's not a big book. He talks about the Inuit Indians living in the Arctic Circle. He talks about the Polynesians, the seafarers who settled the islands of the South Pacific. He talks about also the Inca of Peru and all the Aboriginal peoples in Australia. He must have been a very talented and gifted man, and certainly a very good writer. The stories are so interesting, and they're so enjoyable. And I was saying to this friend of mine, Peter, about the book, and I said, you know, the nice thing about this book is it's so much fun to read, and you're actually learning things all the time. What's interesting about it is that when you see the broad range of human society, the multicolored quilt of human society, and you compare any of these ancient ones to the ones we have today, there's nothing lacking. Modernity has not improved on our imaginations or our gift for living in any way, particularly. At one point he says that every year something like 300 languages are lost. That at the rate we're going, I forget how many thousands of languages there were on the planet, and now we're coming down to a relatively small number. He said, every time you lose a language, it's like losing a whole culture. What it does, it rejoices in the variety and the richness of human culture, ingenuity and expressivity in ways that you could not imagine.
Philip Glass recommends The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, by Wade Davis. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org.
When I was a little boy growing up in Quebec, at a time when the French and the English didn't speak to each other, I grew up in an English suburb that was plunked like a carbuncle in the back of a very old French-Canadian village.
Anthropologist Wade Davis.
And there was literally a boulevard, Cartier Boulevard, that divided the English from the French. And I would go there to get cigarettes or milk from my mom at a little corner store owned by a Francophone couple, delightful old people. And I would sit there as they spoke to me in French and look across that road and think, wow, you know, right across that asphalt is another language, another religion, another way of being. And I was excited about that as a boy of 5 and 6, but also haunted by this sort of subtle prohibition, not from my mom and dad, but from my society that said I shouldn't cross that road. And I guess crossing that road is what I've done all my life.
Wade Davis has been called the Indiana Jones of anthropology. Over the course of his career, he's traveled deep into the Amazon rainforest to meet shamans. He's investigated the Haitian voodoo practice of using neurotoxins to create zombies, and he's climbed high up in the Tibetan mountains, photographing snow leopards. Davis thinks that indigenous people have a fundamentally different way of understanding the world than we do in the modern world.
Let's take the Aboriginal people of Australia. It's a perfect example because there's no civilization that was more diametrically opposed to that of the West. And when the British first arrived in Australia, they saw people who looked strange, who had a simple material technology. And what really offended the British about the Aboriginal people is that they had no interest in progress, in improving upon their lot. And of course, that idea of self-improvement, progress, was the essence of European life. An idea, incidentally, that died in the blood of Flanders, but nevertheless was very much alive in the years of colonial contact with Australia. And because of this, the British, in their inimitable way, concluded that the Aboriginal people weren't human. They began to shoot them. As recently as 1902, in Parliament in Melbourne, it was debated as to whether or not Aboriginal people were human or not. As recently as the 1960s, a school book, A Treasury of Fauna of Australia, listed the Aboriginal people as amongst the interesting forms of wildlife in the country. What the British failed to understand was a devotional philosophy too subtle for their comprehension, and that was a dreaming. And when the ancestors of the Aboriginal people arrived in Australia, the first people we know to walk out of Africa, they went walking, and they established perhaps 10,000 clan territories linked by a single idea. Not just the song lines, which were the trajectories walked at the dawn of time when the ancestors sang the world into existence, but the notion of the dreaming. And what the dreaming was not a dream, but a state of perpetual existence where there was no past, present, or future. Indeed, in not one of the 670 languages and dialects of Australia is there a word for past, present, or future, or a word for time. The dreaming is the eternal moment whereby the world exists and yet is constantly being born in the realm of the dreaming, the realm of the human imagination. Now, what does this really mean? It means that the entire focus of Aboriginal life was the antithesis of progress. The ethos of that civilization was not to improve upon anything, but rather to do the ritual gestures deemed to be necessary to keep the world exactly as it was at the time of its creation. It's as if all of human thought in the West had been invested into pruning the shrubs in the Garden of Eden to keep it just as it was when Adam and Eve had their fateful conversation. It means, for example, you and I were raised to believe that a mountain was a pile of rock ready to be mined. You and I were raised to believe that a forest ultimately is board feet and cellulose. My friends and godchildren in mountains of Peru believe that a mountain is an Apu spirit that will direct their destiny. My friends on the coast of British Columbia believe that those same forests that I logged as a forester were the abode of Hukuk and the crooked beak of heaven, cannibal spirits that had to be embraced during the Hummut's initiation, such that the wisdom of the wild would come back to the people in the potlatch. Now, the point's not to say who's right and who's wrong. The measure of people is not just what they do, but the quality of the metaphors that propel their society forward. The interesting thing is to note how the belief system mediates a relationship between the human population and the natural world with profoundly different consequences in terms of the ecological footprint. You know, the First Nations of British Columbia have lived on those coasts for literally thousands of years with a very modest impact, whereas my particular culture, my ideology, my way of thinking of that forest has torn it asunder in three generations. And this is a really important point. You know, all cultures are ethnocentric, you know, faithful to their own interpretation of realities. You know, people are always saying, oh, you Americans are so full of yourselves. Well, of course we're full of ourselves. Why shouldn't we be? You know, most tribal peoples are full of themselves. Most tribal names mean the people, the implication being that those blokes over the horizon are savages beyond the pale. My argument is that none of us, be it a nation state like America or a tribal society like the Warani, in a multicultural, integrated, pluralistic world, can afford cultural myopia, because that has been the curse of humanity. It's been the cause of all conflict. You know, we have to find ways to get around. And how can we do that? By recognizing that every culture is cut from the same genetic cloth, all have the same genius, all have something to say.
That's Wade Davis. He's an anthropologist, an ethnobotanist, and an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. So what can traditional societies teach us about settling arguments and raising kids? Coming up, Jared Diamond tells us what he's learned from a lifetime of fieldwork in Papua New Guinea. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. It's tempting to think of traditional wisdom as all about craft and working with your hands or developing some kind of deep relationship with the land. But traditional non-Western, non-industrial cultures also have a lot to teach us about basic social skills. Biologist Jared Diamond, he's the guy who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, has been doing fieldwork in Papua New Guinea for decades. And over the years, he's spent a lot of time with indigenous people. And he thinks the most valuable wisdom they have to offer is about how to get along with other people, like how to raise kids, deal with conflict, meet strangers. And he put some of the most important lessons in his book, The World Until Yesterday. Steve Paulson was intrigued.
Your book covers a wide range of traditional societies, but a lot of your most vivid stories come from Papua New Guinea. And I was struck by how completely different certain cultural values are. For instance, when you'd go out with the local guides looking for birds, you often had to be very careful, because if you went across the wrong valley or river, you would be seen as a stranger. You could be killed for that. Can you explain this?
Yes. In the United States, we take for granted the fact that you can walk down a street, you don't need permission, you can walk on forested land. Yes, there is private land, but in New Guinea, every square inch of land is private land. There's no public land, and you always need permission. And some of the big, nasty, dangerous episodes I've been involved in New Guinea have been cases where I got permission from the people that said they owned the land, and then I encountered another batch of people who said, no, this is our land, and you're trespassing, and there is a mess.
So why would that create such conflict if you happen to go onto someone else's land?
People don't welcome, they don't tolerate strangers, because in a traditional society where people don't move around, where you spend your life in the area where you were born, unless you move once to get married, any stranger is there usually for a bad reason, namely to scout out your territory for a raid or to abduct a woman or to steal a pig. And so you just don't encounter strangers, or if you do encounter strangers, it's bad.
So what happens when you actually do encounter a stranger in, let's take Papua New Guinea as an example?
Well, if a New Guinean encounters a stranger in the forest, one of the two will try to run away, or one of the two will try to kill the other. And if they've come around a corner so they can't run away and they don't immediately try to kill each other, then there's no alternative but to sit down and they'll have a discussion for, it may take several hours, naming all their relatives and cross cousins and in-laws in the hope that you can find some relative that you share in common, which means that you've got reason not to want to kill that person. If after a couple of hours you haven't found any shared relative, then there's no grounds not to kill the person. The person really is a stranger, and someone runs or you try to kill.
And that's really sort of an astonishing way to think about strangers. And on the other hand, these same people in New Guinea often have to deal with people in different villages who often spoke completely different languages. And you say that it is common for people there to speak many different languages. I mean, sometimes more than 10 languages.
I personally have never met a New Guinean who spoke fewer than 3 languages. Normal is to speak, say, 5 languages. I remember an occasion where I was at a campfire. There were about 20 New Guineans. And so we just went around on the campfire with everybody counting the number of languages that he spoke or understood. Nobody spoke fewer than 5 languages. The champion spoke 15 languages. And I should emphasize, these are not dialects like Southern American English and New York English. These are different languages, as different as English is from Chinese.
Now, we've been talking about how different certain values are between our own developed world and many traditional societies. And you write about this fascinating case of this one guy who was from a village in New Guinea. He was driving through a neighboring town, and he accidentally hit a young boy and killed him. And it wasn't his fault, but there were all kinds of elaborate measures that were taken as a response to resolve the conflict. Can you describe what happened?
Yes, it's so different from traffic accidents in the United States. It involved a friend of mine who was the employer of a New Guinea driver who accidentally hit and killed a 10-year-old boy who was darting across the road. In the United States, you know, if you have a traffic accident, especially if you accidentally kill someone, right away you're thinking of lawsuits. You're calling your insurance company. The police get in to see whether you were criminally responsible. And the person that you killed is a stranger. Who cares what the relatives think about it? But in New Guinea, where you're going to have to be dealing with those people for the rest of your life, overwhelmingly important is settling it so that you're not going to have enemies for the rest of your life. And in the case of my friend, 5 days after the fatal accident, my friend came, believe it or not, he came to a lunch with the mother and father and uncle and relatives of the dead boy, where my friend brought some compensation, some money, and some food. And my friend and the fellow employees of the driver sat down with the relatives of the dead boy. They ate the meal together. They gave talks. They were crying together. My friend said it was the hardest speech in his life because he was crying so hard, saying, "This money and this food that I'm giving you, it's rubbish. I know what you're going through with the death of your son because I've got children and there's no way that you can compensate for it."
Well, and we should also talk about how you describe this incident up until that moment of reconciliation. After this guy hit and killed this young boy, he knew that if he just stopped and got out of his car, then he could very well have been killed by the people in that town. So he turns himself into the local police and they escort him back to his village. But he's on the lookout for people who might come from that boy's family who want retribution. I mean, it's a very touchy situation.
Yeah, it's a good point that you raise, and it illustrates that dispute resolution in traditional societies can go in either of two directions. One, negotiation and reconciliation, and the opposite side is if the negotiation doesn't succeed, then you've got an enemy for the rest of your life, and the other side will be trying to kill you. And if they can't kill the driver, then they'll settle for killing relatives of the driver. But if they then kill a relative of the driver, then the relative of the driver will want to kill the other side, and you get it spiraling into war. So our court system, our justice system, brings the benefit that we're not involved in constant feuds and warfare, but the downside is that we don't have the reconciliation that a negotiation can produce in a traditional society.
Now, the subtitle of your book is What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? What's the biggest thing that you have learned from the many years of doing field work in New Guinea?
I've learned to think realistically about danger. I've learned to eat healthy and not put salt and sugar on my food. I've learned to give my kids, as they were growing up, as much freedom as possible to make their choices. So whatever goes on in traditional societies, it's often different from our society, and we can learn either something that they do better, or we can learn something that they do worse, and we say, thank God, now I appreciate something about my own society.
Let me follow up on a couple of those things you just mentioned. When you were raising your own children to give them more independence, how is that manifested in some of these traditional societies?
In traditional societies, the view is that an infant or a child is an independent person who should make his or her own choices. In traditional societies, it's carried to what we would consider an extreme, letting young kids play with sharp knives or play near fires. And the idea is that young children got to learn from their own mistakes. Most New Guineans in the highlands that I've seen, they've got scars, fire scars, not because they made a mistake while they were adults, but because they were playing near the fire as a kid.
Well, on the other hand, you also say that in terms of the way babies are raised in a lot of these traditional societies, well, there are these close bonds between mother and baby, and often they're breastfed, for instance, for years.
Routinely, in fact, in traditional societies, children are breastfed until the typical weaning age is around 3, might be 2.5, might be 4. And the reason is that in traditional societies, there aren't domestic animals, there's not cow's milk, there's not wheat to make mushes out of, and so children do nurse for several years. That's one thing that gives kids in traditional societies a sense of security, a sense of close connection. And the end result is that I'm struck by New Guinea children at age 5 or 10 just being more mature, more self-confident, more confident about negotiating with adults than our micromanaged American children who are not permitted to make their own choices and who are brought these pre-made toys by their parents. And finally, they go through the terrible teenage years when they got to make choices and they then start to determine their lives in their 20s. I remember a 10-year-old kid in New Guinea who decided that he was going to be a porter for me and didn't ask his parents who weren't around. He went off and for a week he acted as porter, and then for a month he worked studying birds with me, and he knew that eventually someone would tell his parents that their son went off with a white man who knows where, but a 10-year-old kid in New Guinea is figured to be able to make his own decisions.
Hmm. Do you still go back to New Guinea to do research?
Yes, I do, and I'm going to continue doing it until I'm dead or crippled. I love New Guinea. I've been there 26 times in the last 48 years, and I hope to return to New Guinea the month after next. New Guinea is so fascinating. To be in New Guinea is like briefly seeing the world in color when the rest of the time the world is dull gray. It's a vivid, fascinating place.
That's biologist Jared Diamond talking with Steve Paulson. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, and his new book is called The World Until Yesterday: What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strange-Hams. Thanks for listening.